It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's New York City, a side of the city visitors rarely see. We are touring one of her great culinary neighborhoods with Ben Watson. He's co-author of The Slow Food Guide to New York. It's about handmade, from street pickles and lox to outrageous donuts and gelato, all on the Lower East Side. Well, the Stearns are doing L.A.'s oldest and still jammed celeb hangout, Musso and Frank. Sally Schneider comes to the rescue with homemade gifts that have lots of style, but little work. Then we hear a tale of quivering family dysfunction in the form of a Jell-O salad, and we get a firsthand report from a citrus grower. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be you me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid love me, best way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, and never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry. Agree slowly. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap, when I say do it. Send out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut be a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug.
hug me new with thunder burden me. You heard me, I am getting hungry.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, we go to New York City, into a great culinary neighborhood few visitors get to. It's the Lower East Side. Our guide is Ben Watson, co-author of The Slow Food Guide to New York. Now, we are covering the waterfront, from street pickles and great lox to outrageous donuts and gelato. Ingenious cook Sally Schneider comes to the rescue with homemade gifts with lots of style but little work. We hear about the passing on of a loving family tradition, a.k.a. the great Jell-O debacle. Then we get a first-hand report on the citrus season from a family farm. And as always in the second half of the show, we are opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, you know, I realize something. I always think of you guys being in the country. Do you hit cities much?
We certainly do. In fact, we were just in Hollywood, California, where we ate at Hollywood's oldest restaurant, which is Musso and Frank on Hollywood Boulevard. It's been there since 1919 and has long been a favorite of what used to be called the movie colony.
1919. I mean, that's when there were orange groves in what's now L.A., right?
Exactly. This is when Hollywood was this kind of paradisical place where they set up the movie studios and people cavorted in all kinds of ways that were that only movie stars could do. And this restaurant goes back to that time. It's a very elegant restaurant in its own kind of extremely dated way, a sort of Tudor, very, very dark place, just the kind of place you want to go and have a Rob Roy or a Manhattan or a martini before your meal.
So this is fancy food.
Well, yes and no.
It's real hearty American food. It's the kind of American food that James Beard used to really sing the praises of. Wonderful grilled items, grilled seafood, grilled lamb chops, grilled steaks. And unlike so many modern menus and like so many menus of the early 1900s, they have a choice of, I think it's 11 different type or a dozen different types of potatoes. You've read old menus where there's Well, here at Musso and Frank, they still have, you know, julienne, mashed, lyonnaise, au gratin, hash browns, cottage fries, and on and on and on and on, which is, you know, just such a wonderful homage to the past.
And there are some, let's call them sort of fancy entrees, like you can get spaghetti italienne. And that's the one listed on the menu, as opposed to some other kind of spaghetti.
German spaghetti. Spaghetti chinoise. And Wednesday is sauerbraten day. Thursday is chicken pot pie day. You know, short ribs on Saturday. It's really a temple of old-fashioned American cuisine. You can get great rice pudding there. You can, you know, anything that flannel cakes.
Well, flannel cakes are one of their specialties. At lunch only, you can either get them as a side dish, as many people do, or as an entree themselves. These are kind of wafer thin, plate wide pancakes made to order. I mean, so to call this place fancy is totally wrong because these are just pancakes, but they're really good, thin, elegant, made-to-order pancakes. One of the great things about Musso and Frank, I have to say, is that in addition to extremely private, high-backed booths, where if you're a celebrity, you can kind of secret yourself, there is also a very long counter with extremely comfortable stools. I mean, they're actually chairs with arms on them that swivel, and you can sit at the counter and watch the grill men cook steaks, which, frankly, if I had only one meal at Musso's, it would be like steak and potatoes, because there's none better. In
11 different kinds, yeah.
The yes. roast beef hash?
Well, the roast beef hash is spectacularly good. I'd have that the next day after my steak.
And well, also, I have to say, we have a perfect record of celebrity spotting whenever we've eaten at Musso and Frank. And it's kind of like that old episode of I Love Lucy, you know, where she's like, you know, hanging over the back of the, you know, of the leather banquette to sort of look at the celebrities. Michael and I have all sorts of out of focus, blurry pictures taken, you know, trying to pretend we're going from the table to the bathroom. And, you know, in fact, we're snapping pictures of many celebrities.
So I was going to ask you, you know, who goes there? So it is a place where celebrities still go.
When you sit at the counter, it's really interesting because it's a great place to go if you're a single diner, because the counter is so comfortable. You see a lot of guys reading Daily Variety. And I assume that even the ones that we don't recognize are probably important producers or directors.
And interestingly enough, for such a kind of a corny place, I always see very famous rock and roll people. Like, well, Bob Seger was sat next to us. In the next booth.
He asked if he could sit next to us.
Yes, yeah. And he was taking pictures of us.
Right. Yeah.
Well, okay, we know now where to go to have celebrity spotting
and
to
also
eat
macaroni au gratin,
yes.
Which
boy.
Is fabulous.
Oh boy, and 11 kinds of potatoes. Hey,
oh,
thanks,
so
guys.
Fabulous.
Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique and shopping tips, and it is free. So sign up. That's splendidtable.org. Food expert Sally Schneider is one of those people with innate style. Not only does she make dishes healthier without losing a jot of the flavor, Sally has this touch, this simplicity that makes things irresistible. Sally is author of A New Way to Cook, and she's one of our regular visitors. Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Darling, I need some ideas for homemade Christmas gifts.
You need my main holiday food strategy, Lynn.
Which is?
I make big batches of wonderful foods that I can give as gifts, very simple ones. And the reason I make big batches is so I can use them myself for my own entertaining. So I have a few standbys, and I take an afternoon and make them up, and after that I don't have to think about it.
Oh, this is great. Okay, what are your standbys?
Really simple. Tapas bar roasted almonds. These are my version of the spectacular, addictive almonds served in tapas bars in Spain with glasses of bone-dry Manzanilla sherry. I make up batches, I pack them in pretty boxes or tins, and bundle them with a half bottle of this fine dry sherry, with instructions to serve it chilled with the almonds. Then, when guests drop by, I pull the almonds out and the Manzanilla sherry and serve it along with thin slices of prosciutto or Spain Serrano ham, and I have instant hors d'oeuvres and drinks.
So what is in these almonds? I mean, what do you do to them?
There are three ingredients. All you do is take whole blanched almonds, scatter them on a baking sheet, toss them with a little extra virgin olive oil, and then roast them at a 300-degree oven until they're honey-colored, which will take about 40 to 45 minutes. Then the trick to make them super crisp, you open the oven door, turn the oven off, let it cool down for about 30 seconds, close the door and let the almonds sit until the oven is completely cool, then toss them with sea salt. That's it. They'll last for weeks in a tin. You can make huge batches. You don't need quantities or a recipe even to do it. And everybody I give them to freaks out because they're so delicious.
Okay. All right. Another idea.
Another along the hors d'oeuvre line, because I find that during the holidays, that's what I'm most pressed for. I make rosemary-scented Niçoise olives. I make a quick rosemary oil by heating extra virgin olive oil with some fresh rosemary spikes that I've coarsely chopped, maybe a crushed clove of garlic. Mm-hmm. And then I turn off the heat and I let it infuse overnight and drain it. Then I pour this over Niçoise olives that I've drained, and I let them marinate in it. They'll last indefinitely in the refrigerator. They're just delicious the way they are. Then you can use them to serve with fresh goat cheese. You can put them on bruschetta or something like that. You can even throw them in stews and things like that. They're just wonderful.
Oh, this sounds good.
Easy.
Any ideas for sweets?
Yes, I have a strategy for sweets, which is to bake butter cookies and then pack them with a wonderful tea. And I might choose a fine estate Darjeeling or Oolong, an Earl Green, which is green tea scented with bergamot, a fragrant lemon verbena from France, or a jasmine-scented green tea that's rolled into little pearls that unfurl in the cup. I find that butter cookies are the best thing to give with teas because they won't overwhelm the flavor. Now, you can use any of your favorite butter cookie recipes, and if you want to jazz them up, you can scent the dough with grated Meyer lemon zest, because Meyer lemons are in season, fresh ginger, spices like cracked cardamom or nutmeg. Clove is lovely with grated lemon zest. You can even just scrape out the seeds from a vanilla bean and mix it in the dough to have a really power-packed vanilla cookie.
This is great. So you could use even a mix. I mean, if you're pushed to the wall and you add these kinds of flavorings.
Exactly. By adding the flavorings, you're really making them your own and making them unique. So whatever gets it done for you, I say do it.
What about packing up? How do you present this? Any great ideas there?
Well, first of all, I am too busy and too old to worry about doing jazzy packaging. So what I do is in the course of the year, I go to flea markets and pick up old canning jars, tins, and boxes, which are really charming. In a pinch, I order some of the really pretty canning jars that are around, like Weck jars, which look like French canning jars. Mm-hmm. And I buy a couple of rolls of ribbon, and that's it. And everybody is delighted when they get this bonus of a wonderful antique, in quotes, box or container with something delicious in it.
And if it comes from 1980, that's still an antique in our... Yes, I got it.
These days, it definitely is.
Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, for your edification, we've put Sally's homemade gift recipes on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Slow Food takes us inside New York City, the Great Family Jell-O debacle, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve them up. You can visit them online at Target.com. One of the great things about cities is their ethnic neighborhoods. Now, New York City, for instance, is chock-a-block with them. Cross a street and you've stepped from one country to another. Talk about a paradise of handmade and traditional. Well, that's the meat of the Slow Food Guide to New York. We took a tour with co-author Ben Watson in one of New York City's oldest neighborhoods, the Lower East Side.
Okay, Ben, now we're at our first place. We're on Grand Street.
Grand Street at Norfolk.
Okay, and we're at the Donut Plant. Why the Donut Plant in the Slow Food Guide?
Mark Israel, the baker at the Donut Plant, has the most amazing donuts, as you will see when we go inside. He uses incredible ingredients for his glazes, Valrhona chocolate, Tahitian vanilla.
Good Lord.
Specialty glazes, seasonal fruits in his thing, so we couldn't leave him out of there. They're some of the best donuts, and they're also carried all over the city.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I should explain to everybody, this is a storefront. It's like you're walking into a bakery. There are piles of flour. There's a few old stools. There's papers piled. And there's this little teeny counter, and there's a little rack with donuts on it.
Literally two chairs and a production bakery. That's about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, this is certainly not a glamorous place.
Not at all.
Can we go inside?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Okay. Hi, I'm Lynn.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great.
Welcome to Donut Plant.
Thank you. You're Mark, right?
Right, yeah, Mark Israel.
How did you start this?
Well, I started it in a basement of a tenement building on the Lower East Side 9 years ago with my grandfather's recipe. There's a picture of Grandpa over there. This is a recipe that he invented in the 1930s.
I'm just looking at the list here. We've got cinnamon buns, and you've got Valrhona chocolate donuts, walnut donuts. You've got fresh pumpkin and ginger donuts, roasted pecan donuts. This donut is this is the donut that ate Manhattan.
It's beautiful, right?
That has to be maybe 5 inches across. I could float down the East River in this. Could I have a bite?
It's beautiful, right?
Okay.
Very fluffy.
Ooh, he's pulling it apart, and there's this great.
These are unlike any donuts that you've ever had, probably. These are not your Krispy Kremes.
All right, I'm going to take a taste.
Absolutely, go for it.
Mm. Oh, brother. These melt in your mouth.
Thanks, Mark.
The vanilla comes through loud and clear.
Yeah, that's a combination of three kinds of vanilla bean. Madagascar, Tahitian, and Mexican.
God forbid you should leave anybody out, right?
You know, Lynn, one of the other reasons that we love this place is we always like places that close when they run out of stuff, like pizza places. And Mark's place, the Donut Plant, is one of these places in New York. They sell them until they run out of what their batch for the day, and then they're done. That's the closing time.
So if you want to eat the donuts, you've got to get here by what time, Mark?
Well, we usually close between 5 and 7 at night. We open at 6:30 in the morning. But today we've run out of donuts twice already.
So these could be the quintessential New York donuts.
I have to tell you, it is like eating a great sweet bread.
Aren't they great? Thanks, Mark.
You're so welcome. Thank you for coming.
Okay, Ben, where do we go next?
Next, Lynn, we are going literally just up the block to the Temple of Bialys, Kosar's Bialys. And this is going to bring you back to the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
This is your welcome back.
So, Ben, tell me about this next stop.
Kosar's Bialys was founded, it's the oldest Bialy bakery in the country, and was founded back in 1936, and it's generally recognized as making the best Bialys, which are like flatbreads. Somebody called them one time Jewish English muffins, so I think that was the Time Out review. But that's kind of unfair to them. They're a totally different thing. They're like a bagel without a hole, if you can
right.
What I'm talking about. They sort of have a little depression in the middle, and they're filled with luscious caramelized onions, and they're just delightful breakfast rolls, or put a little schmear and a little
the
fish
schmear
on
being
there. Cream cheese.
This is another storefront, right, Ben?
Right.
And in the window, there's these, they look like large flatbreads. They're puffy.
Those are pretzels.
Those are pretzels?
I believe, yeah, just like supersized bialys. They almost
look
like
small pizza. So it's a pretzel meeting up with a bagel, meeting up with a bialy.
Meeting up with a whole lot of poppy seeds.
And we're right in the middle of the bakery. Oh, oh, this is great.
And if you notice on the price board up here, the bialys are 50 cents. Such a deal.
Nowhere is anything 50 cents anymore. Hello, yes. Could I please have a bialy?
Sure.
Okay.
What kind? We have two kinds of bialys, onion or garlic.
Oh, I think I want onion if I could.
Okay.
Okay.
How many?
You know,
I'll
take
one,
two of them.
Yeah.
Two.
Of each. Two onion and two garlic?
Yeah, let's do two onion and two garlic.
What else?
You know what? I'd love to try a pretzel.
I'll get it.
Yeah. Okay, that's it. That's it.
That's
how much is that?
$4.
$4?
And the great thing is that you can order these, if you're not in New York City, you can also order them online, and they're still 50 cents a piece.
Bye.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You
Thanks.
Too.
Thanks very much.
Oh, tug at the tooth, chewy. Oh.
The best thing to do with these, I'm talking with my mouth full.
No, but that's fine. I am too.
Is to warm it up in the oven just a little bit. You do not split a bialy.
You put butter on top of it.
You put the stuff right on the top in the center, let it run down inside there.
It has a big trough in the center, and this is so, oh good. Oh, Ben, dare I ask, what's next?
Well, Lynn, we're heading over to put something on your bialys. We're going to go over to Russ and Daughters and get some incredible smoked fish.
Here on, let's go.
Well, Lynn, here we are. We're on Houston Street now. We've walked up, and we're in front of Russ and Daughters Appetizers, if you notice the sign.
Right.
And this place has been here since 1914 was when the business was started by a guy named Joe Russ. And Russ and Daughters, as you might gather, it was his daughters took over for him and worked with him and ran the next generation in the business. And there's still a Russ running it right now, Mark Russ.
Can we go
Wanna
inside?
Go in
yep, let's
sure.
go. As we walk by the counters,
there's... smells just great.
It smells incredible. It smells of smoked fish, and there's whole smoked fish in the case. All kinds of sides of fish that look like they've been smoked, spreads, scallion, cream cheese, smoked salmon, lox, Norwegian salmon, Scotch salmon, Gaspé, Nova.
Can you decide?
No.
Mark, this is Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Yes, we've met.
Hello, Mark.
How are you?
Good to see you.
And this is Josh Tupper, my nephew, the fourth generation of Russ and Daughters.
Good to meet you, Josh.
Very nice to meet you.
Mark, I want to know, this term appetizer or appetizing store, that was a very common term for a type of store.
Right.
What does that really mean?
I can tell you what it means. I can't tell you where it came from.
Okay.
Or who started it. It was designed to separate this type of store, which sells primarily fish and dairy items,
right,
from what was then, we're talking about the turn of the century roughly, delicatessens, which meant strictly meat products, pickled, cured meats. And this was pickled and cured fish and then dairy items. Because of the kosher laws, there was no mixture of meat and dairy, so you really needed two separate stores.
How do you feel about being part of Slow Food? I mean, this is such a generational business. You've been here for so long.
Yeah, we're quite pleased to be recognized as a type of business that is attempting to hold on to traditions, albeit it doesn't always mean maximizing your profit. What we do here is very slow. Hand slicing salmon, pickling herrings, all of this is very slow process. So we fit in perfectly with the movement.
It's also great to have all of the different kinds of cured fish, the variety of this. You really have knowledge of the people who work behind the counters here, and they know so much in the store, and they can help you find exactly what you're looking for in a wide range of tastes. And it involves knowing something about food and caring a lot about food, and that's obvious when you walk in the store.
Thank you so much.
We thank you very much for including us.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, Lynn, here we are in front on, we're on Orchard Street, great old street in Lower East Side, and we're in front of Gus's Pickles, which is just a wonderful place. It's been open for, since about 1910, I believe, is when they opened it up in the first place. But there used to be five pickle makers in a two-block radius of this area back in the days, and this is the only one left, but they are the greatest. This epitomizes slow food to me. Gus's Pickles on a spring day. You see the barrels that are sitting right out here on the street. Big barrels of pickles. We've got half sour pickles, full sour pickles, and they're all cold brine. These are not your Vlasic pickles that are boiled and absorb the brine. These are long and slow brined, cold brined pickles.
And this is a great tradition, but I'm looking, there's also some pickled peppers,
yep.
And it's literally...
Artichokes, they have garlic. You can get almost anything pickled here.
And this actually, is big, you see it right red up barrels that come well above my waist sitting in the front of a storefront. How much are the pickles?
Pickles are sold by the quart. They're $6 a quart. Or by the piece, they're 2 for $1, which is good if you're going to walk down the street and eat them right now.
Should we have a taste?
Could we try... Let's try a half sour. Could we try a half sour?
The one where the garlic just went.
Yeah. Let's... Uh-huh. The fresh pickles are great.
Oh, thank you.
So what do you think of that?
It's a fresh cucumber, very crunchy, permeated mm-hmm. with salt and garlic. Oh, yeah.
You really taste the salt in these.
Yeah.
But the ones that are brined longer obviously absorb most of the brine. And you'll taste mustard seed, bay leaves. Well, you can see what they're putting
on
the top
bay here. Leaves are going in there, the
mustard seed,
coriander.
Hot peppers. It's a secret recipe, but it's no secret as to what they put in there. It's all good stuff, and it's mm-hmm. all natural ingredients.
Hey, thanks a lot. You're very welcome.
Let's keep going. Lynn, we've gone from pickles to ice cream. This is the last stop on our little tour here. We're at Il Laboratorio del Gelato.
My people.
Your people.
Tell me about the place, though.
This place is actually one of the newest places that we put in the Slow Food Guide. It only opened in August 2002, and it was started by John Snyder, who makes the ice cream right in the back here.
I would say this place is the size of a large closet with a very deep back to it. It's very small, painted white, and there are tubs of gelato. There's maybe 12 tubs. We've got rice gelato, mocha, Black Mission fig, honey lavender. That mm-hmm. sounds really
these
good. Cinnamon. Oh, coconut sorbet, green apple sorbet.
Yeah, and the sorbets, actually, he sources some of the fruits that he uses for these, and they're mostly pure fruit. There's not a whole lot of even sugar in them. They're almost 100% fruit, and he gets them from the green market over at Union Square.
So it's locally sourced.
John, hi.
Hi. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. You guys arrived. I'm just in the middle of making some prune Armagnac gelato, and it has to come out of the machine. So if you want to follow me back while I'm doing it, you can do that.
Sure.
It's a little tight quarters back there.
Okay.
But it's just really coming out of the machine. So
great.
It's more of a visual thing in a way, but I can kind of talk and while I'm doing it.
Oh, radio can be very visual, John.
All right.
Now, the gelato is being squeezed out from around a disc. From the stainless steel machine.
That's right.
Has it been whipped, John?
Yes. Well, what happens is we put the ingredients inside the machine, and the milk, the cream, the sugar. And in this instance, this is a prune Armagnac. So we use a Bass Armagnac, which is a type of brandy.
Right.
And we use pitted, dried prunes, which we chop up and dice. And that all goes in, and then about 20 minutes later, the product is ready. And it basically, what the machine does is it both freezes and whips up at the same time.
John, you're a young guy, but you've been doing this for a long time, I gather. Your grandmother was in the business, right?
That's right. My grandfather actually was a contractor, and he built many of the Carvel stores.
The soft ice cream.
That's right, for Tom Carvel.
As you're talking, I am watching. The machine has a little door that John lifts, and out comes a great, lovely, thick ribbon of what looks like satiny cream.
That's right.
This is torture.
Yeah.
Watching
is difficult, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and this is one of the greatest places to come on a hot afternoon in July or August to come down to the Lower East Side. You're dying for some great ice cream, and just walk around with your dish of this gelato that's just incredible.
Thank you so much. You're driving me crazy, but I really am glad that you had the time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
You can imagine what was in my carry-on bag on the trip home. Well, Ben Watson is co-author with Patrick Martins of The Slow Food Guide to New York City. You can find information on the shops we visited at splendidtable.org. The passing on of traditions happens in every family. One generation lovingly hands off customs to the next. Sometimes the transfer is warm and fuzzy. Sometimes it's just short of harrowing, like in the family of writer Mary Raines.
So, I'm in the kitchen on Christmas Eve, and I'm trying to assemble everything needed for the dish I'm supposed to bring to my family gathering the following day. And I'm having some anxiety. See, my family of origin is all about ritual. In a clan so scattershot with dysfunction, it seems the rituals are the only things that hold everything in place. Every Christmas, without fail, we have a baked ham, scalloped potatoes, brown and serve rolls, and the infamous seven-layer Jell-O ribbon salad. My mother's always made the ribbon salad because, as she puts it, it has to be done right. But this Christmas, she's feeling so ill that she tells me, in a broken voice, that she must give up the task. "You're the oldest," she says to me wanly over the phone on Christmas Eve morning. I know what I have to do. Sick as she is, she dictates the recipe with such exactitude that two sheets of notebook paper later, I finally hang up. Then I go find my husband. I plead with him to help me, and he obliges, even though he's rented It's a Wonderful Life, which we watch on Christmas Eve every year. He does the math and announces this salad will take about 7 hours to make. One by one, each of four colors of Jell-O must be made, put into a bowl to set up slightly, then poured into a cake pan. Each color is then layered with a special sour cream, sugar, and gelatin mixture and left to set up for 45 minutes. The process is then repeated until there are seven layers. I send my husband to the store to get the ingredients, and then we begin. I plan to, over the course of the evening, clear out a spot in the refrigerator so the salad can set up, but for now, we decide to put it in the garage to cool down between layers. We pause It's a Wonderful Life every 15 minutes to check on the gelling process. By layer 3, I'm ready for bed and sick of the salad. By layer 5, I realize my husband has brought me a blue Jell-O instead of the required orange. The store is now closed. By the 7th layer, I'm exhausted. I could care less about George Bailey and his troubles. We go to bed. The following morning, I awaken and look at the outside temperature gauge and scream. The salad has been left in the garage, where it is surely below zero. All the way to my mother's house, I hold the pan in my lap and it is sloshing. I perspire as I uncover the salad at the table, and suddenly there's a hush, and my dear son smirks and says, "I hope Grandma has straws." My mother hobbles to the table and goes pale. Someone quickly gets her a chair. Then, as my sister tries to ladle out the first portion with a gravy spoon, my mother spies the blue layer. Her mouth, with the fringe of yellow fuzz over the top lip, freezes in the open position. "Is that blue?" she asks in the same tone of voice as if she were asking, "Is that a cold sore?" And then my husband comes to my rescue. He takes the heat entirely, the garage, the blue Jell-O, everything. He gets bowls, straws, tries to cheerfully cajole picky nieces into taking a sip. He jokes to nephews that all males in the family should sign a prenuptial agreement which says one should never assist with the preparation of the seven-layer Jell-O ribbon salad. That night, he comforts me by telling me that family's not just about ritual, it's about memories. Then we settle in to watch the final half of It's a Wonderful Life. Maybe the best thing about that movie is you realize you're not alone in experiencing times in life when everything flops. Sometimes it's about money. Sometimes, thankfully, it's just about Jell-O.
Writer Mary Raines makes her Jell-O ribbon salad in both Minnesota and Montana. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What happened when Kentucky Fried Chicken launched their bird and their slogan, Finger Lickin' Good, in China? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what happened when Kentucky Fried Chicken launched their bird and their slogan, Finger Lickin' Good, in China? Well, in short, it was a disaster. Because in China, Finger Lickin' Good came out as Eat Your Fingers Off. Now, that's not the only gaffe that's happened in advertising when it goes from one country to another. Sharwood's, a maker of Indian food, spent a fortune launching their Bunda line of North Indian sauces. Well, in the Punjabi area of northern India, Bunda is a not nice word for rear anatomy. In Spain, the Coors Beer tagline, Turn It Loose, became suffer from, and I guess to put it delicately, unfortunate digestive problems. And back in China, Pepsi unwittingly offered new life. Their slogan, Pepsi brings you back to life, translated as, Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the grave. Now, this all came from an article in a British paper. The moral here? Invest in a good dictionary before spending a dime on international advertising.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We've got Dan calling. So, Dan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and question.
Oh, you're welcome.
Enjoy your program a lot.
Thank you.
When a recipe includes anchovy paste, it typically calls for an amount much less than the 2 or 3 ounces that are supplied with the purchase of a tube of paste.
That's right, which could probably supply anchovy paste for most of your neighborhood.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So how long can one keep an open tube of anchovy paste in the refrigerator for use in a subsequent recipe before the product spoils?
All right. On the safe side, 3 to 4 months. But it has to be cold, and of course it has to be sealed.
Is freezing an option?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It might separate a little bit. The oils might separate a bit from the paste, but, you know, that's no big deal because when you squirt it out, you're probably mixing it into something anyway.
So tapenade every 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. That's
excellent.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
You got it.
Bye.
You take
Bye-bye.
Care. You know, this whole thing about things that are fermented and salted and dried, I'll give you an instance. You can buy whole salted anchovies that are packed in salt, and those puppies will keep for a year, 2 years. It's really amazing. And, you know, all of this goes back to the days before refrigeration. And, I mean, we're talking 1,000 years back. Okay, I think this is Dan Day because we have Dan calling from Madison. Hey, Dan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question is, I heard your show in a prior week of the Thanksgiving show about carving the turkey. And my question is regarding carving smaller birds.
Uh-huh.
I do a lot of hunting, and often I'm serving ducks and grouse and pheasant and woodcock. And sometimes I find it's kind of awkward to serve, you know, find a good way to serve the bird when I'm roasting it whole,
yeah,
so that it's not real messy for the guests who are eating it.
You know, it's a good question. By the way, you have me salivating because the idea that you have access to all those great game birds, but that's beside the point. it's the same idea as was described in when we were talking about carving the big turkey.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing you usually always do is remove a leg, thigh, and wing from one side of the bird. Now, if we back up even further, just make sure you've got a long blade, thin-bladed knife that's as sharp as can be,
mm-hmm,
and a sturdy fork. Now, the reason why you remove that from the side of the bird, now you have an entirely flat side of the bird that you can turn over.
Okay.
And then what you can do is start to slice away. You take away the wing from the other side, and then you can slice away the breast. And when you're dealing with things like dove and woodcock, you know, things that are really tiny,
mm-hmm,
one of the things you want to do often is just cut the whole breast out.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe make a few, 3-4 slices. And you can just fan that on the plate. And if you're really uncomfortable doing that in front of people, do it in the kitchen. Because, you know, sometimes I find it nerve-wracking having to carve in front of guests.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But if you flatten out one side of the bird and then just turn it over on its side, remove the wing, and then you can start working away on that breast meat, then you can take the thigh and the leg that you cut first,
mm-hmm,
and you can start slicing off of that as well. And that's if you want everything off the bone. And ideally, everybody gets a little bit of the breast meat and gets a leg or a thigh. And when you're dealing with really little birds, I mean, I like to have the breast meat as a little, you know, slice or so, but then give people something they can nibble on with their fingers.
Sure, yeah.
Yep.
Lots of times, you know, you just have to serve it whole and
yeah, exactly,
let them fend for themselves.
Exactly. Well, you know, when you have quail, which people can actually buy in the stores, that's the best way to serve it because everybody works with their fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get used to that, they feel free and they have a very good time.
Hey, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. You take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. If you can get your hands on fresh game, especially at this time of year, oh, what wonderful eating. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have Susie calling from Pocosin, Virginia. Susie, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. And actually, it's Pocosin, Virginia.
Excuse me. Where is Pocosin, Virginia?
It's near Williamsburg and Hampton and Newport News.
Oh, it's lovely country, isn't it?
Yes. It's very, very pretty, right on the water. And, and therein lies my problem.
Uh-huh.
Isabel was our visitor in September.
Oh, yeah, the hurricane.
Yeah. And my house was flooded, and I lost all my cookbooks.
Oh, no.
And I'm one of these people who I'm just as happy to sit down and read a cookbook as I am any other kind of book.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so I'm looking for good sources to hopefully get some of those replaced. I had some old ones that were my mom's and just ones that I've collected over.
Right,
you know,
right.
My,
it's like losing friends. Yeah, I mean, it's like losing friends.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just thinking if something happened to my collection. Okay, so we need sources for you. All right.
Right, and I know
and they're out of print. A lot of them are out of print.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a commandment that I operate on, thou shalt not pay retail.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, one source, the first source that comes to mind is half.com. It's part of eBay, but if you just go to half.com on the web, there people will put up titles of books, and every seller will offer it at a slightly different price.
Oh, okay.
So you can choose the price you want to pay and the condition that you want the book to be in.
Right.
And there's a lot of out-of-print stuff on there, because there are also a lot of bookstores that are actually selling on half.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to go. Now, there is a bookseller that is online, but they're also, you can call them. They're based in New York, and they carry everything you can imagine. It's called Kitchen Arts and Letters. And they're in New York City, and they are devoted entirely to everything to do with food and drink. And they would have some stuff that other people don't have.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, be careful, because once you start learning what they do have, forget about the replacement. You just start adding. I mean,
right.
they are a fabulous source for everything you can imagine from published and books published, you know, outside of the country as well.
Right.
Now, there is, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and this may be a case of a phone call. I'm not sure if they have a website.
Okay.
The Wine and Food Library. And they specialize, it's Jan Lungoni and her husband, Daniel. And these two are real scholars. But the great thing about them is they have everything from very rare books to things like old Better Homes and Gardens.
That's one of my favorites that I lost. Was I had several editions of that.
And they would probably have them. And they have a lot of those wonderful spiral-bound books done by local organizations.
Right.
And also, just talking to Jan or Daniel, they are the dearest people in the world. And they, you know, often they're the kind of people who say, oh, we don't have that, but let me tell you where to go.
Oh, yeah.
So that's probably a phone call. It's Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
Then there is another source. Is Abe, it's abe.com.
Okay.
And the thing about this is they deal with all these used books, and they'll do searches for you. So
oh.
they'll send you to all kinds of sites.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And one last thought, and a site I keep meaning to spend more time on, eGullet. E-G-U-L-L-E-T. It's where everybody talks about food. And if you say to people, where can I find blah, blah, you'll probably have 100 people coming in and telling you what to do.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to make a lot of new friends.
Oh, foodie friends.
Yeah, this is great. This is great.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, you take care. You know, one door closes, another one opens.
Right, right. Thank you very much.
Have a great holiday.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Susie. Remember some of these sites. Some of them are up on our website. They're great sources for gifts. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now. We've got Eugene calling. Eugene is calling from Grand Rapids. Hey, Eugene, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Yeah, the question I want to ask you is my wife and I both enjoy cooking, and we want to do stuff a little bit healthier, and so we've been trying to use ghee, and we want to make our own. Well, we've tried that various times. We try to make it different ways, and it always turns out soupy. It doesn't come out solid like when you buy it in a store.
Uh-huh.
What are we doing wrong?
Well, I'm not sure. Now, why don't you explain to everyone what ghee is? Because I think a lot of people aren't familiar with it.
Well, ghee is like rendered butter. It's you take all the impurities out of it, and you cook it for a while, and you're able to leave it out instead of having it in the fridge. And it becomes a solid and use it for various types of cooking. It actually makes food taste very, very good.
Yeah, well, what it is, yeah, you remove all the solids. When you melt butter, you have all those solids at the bottom of the pan or floating on top, and you just scoop that out. And you can also cook at a higher temperature with ghee because you don't have the butter solids to burn. It's pure butter fat. That's essentially what ghee is. I know what you mean. You buy it, and it's solid. I have always, whenever I've made it myself, I haven't cared if it's liquid or not, as long as it works. I don't think you have a problem there. There may be something mixed into the commercial ghee that would have it be solid at room temperature. Yeah. But there is something I should tell you. You still are cooking with butter.
Well, that's true.
You're cooking with a saturated fat. I mean, just so you know that.
Yes.
Yeah. But, Eugene, I would not worry. You are making your ghee right. I think that they add something to the stuff in the store. I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, thank you kindly.
Hey, you are welcome. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. But, you know, any kind of farming is like playing Russian roulette, especially these days when small family farms are closing up so fast. Well, a couple of years ago, fruit expert David Karp raved over a small citrus grower in California. Snow's Citrus Court. Well, we have Raylene Snow on the line. Raylene, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure, truly.
So what kind of a year has this been for you? And is this kind of the make or break month for you guys?
This honestly is. This is the start of the picking season. You know, we're very, very sensitive about picking tree ripe and shipping immediately. We don't pick and store the fruit, and we raise without pesticides or chemicals. So when our CEO, Mother Nature, takes over and says, the fruit is ripe and it's time to pick and ship, then we're on alert. So it really is. This is the time of season that we really pay attention to the fruit.
What things do you actually grow?
We grow the Owari Satsuma Mandarin Orange and Meyer Lemons, Bears Limes, the Chandler Pomelo, and kumquats. We're a small grove, but we pay a lot of attention to citrus. That's really our focus.
And Bears Limes, I've not heard of those. Are they very different than other limes?
You know, they're truly a Tahitian lime, and they're low in acid, they're intense in flavor. You can start using them when the skin is green, but they're a full size. A lime can be, say, the size of a large walnut or a small baseball, but they start out green, but when they're fully ripe, they can be orange. They can be just a bright, bright lemon yellow that's almost a cusp of an orange, but it's a delicious lime.
Mm. How do you market your fruit if you're picking tree ripe? It doesn't have a super long shelf life, does it?
No, it doesn't. And so we have a web page, and we also do festivals and events, and I have two published cookbooks, a little bit of media advertising and hard copy with the paper, and some television work.
So, you know, I'm thinking of something. You grow mandarin oranges, and I always thought that a lot of people looked at a mandarin as something that came only in a can. How do you change that attitude?
I looked at catalogs, and I could never find a tree with a can on it, and I really tried. You know, it does get into a matter of education, and one thing that we started in Placer County in our little town of Newcastle was a Mountain Mandarin Orange Festival, and it really is a celebration of this little fruit, and it did educate people first in our area, you know, close by, people thinking, oh, I didn't know we raised citrus here, and now it's had a little wider spread, so people realize that mandarins do come on a tree with a little skin and everything.
Gee, that's amazing.
It is, isn't it?
Hey, Raylene Snow, thanks so much for talking with us, and may this be a happy and prosperous holiday for you and your family.
Thank you. And just one little ending. You know, it started out that giving the Owari Satsuma was to indicate health and prosperity, and so to you too, Lynn.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You take care.
Thank you so much.
Raylene Snow raises organic citrus fruit on her farm, Snow's Citrus Court, near Auburn, California. Now, for information on Raylene's fruit, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought on architecture from several centuries ago. What is a roofless cathedral compared to a well-built pie? The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.